First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
New data shows Jacksonville is driving in the wrong direction towards its goal of zero pedestrian deaths. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, the deadly streets of Duval, for pedestrians, that is, and what's being done about it. Already getting your calls? Join the conversation. It's 549-2937. Then later, we will check in on the trial of three Georgia men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery as jury selection continues there today in Brunswick. But first this hour, new data from the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles shows that Duval County is speeding in the opposite direction of the city's goal of zero pedestrian deaths. Last year, 45 pedestrians were killed in traffic in this county, and the county has already surpassed that number so far this year, according to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. Jacksonville is one of the most dangerous cities in the country for pedestrians, also cyclists. Claire Heddles of WJCT News has been looking into the numbers, and she joins us now in studio. Claire, good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And as we talk about how dangerous Jacksonville is for pedestrians and also bicyclists, we want you to give us a call, everybody. Do you think twice before going out on the roads on foot or on your bike? Give us a call with your concerns about this. Very few truly walkable neighborhoods in this city. 549-2937. Join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page always open. So Claire, this data just released shows what we really have known for some time. It's a dangerous business getting out and walking across this county. What are you finding in the numbers?
It's true. So we saw on Friday, JSO reported to us that a pedestrian was hit and killed near Edward Waters University on Kings Road. And she was the 45th person to be hit by a car walking so far this year. And there was 45 last year, 45 the year before that. And that number has been climbing basically over the past decade. So a 46th person was hit early Monday morning near the Jacksonville Zoo. So now at this point in the year, we've had more people die on our streets walking than any year prior, and it's only October.
And so we're setting a new record. A study from the National Complete Streets Coalition that you're reporting on that was released earlier this year finds we are the 10th most dangerous metropolitan area in the country for pedestrians. What does the study attribute that to?
So it's a mix. Some of it is the history of Jacksonville's development and the wide streets that we have in our suburbs that were meant to transport people into the city for working. So we have streets that are seven lanes wide with parking lanes and turning lanes. And so it takes pedestrians a long time to cross the street. And a lot of our crosswalks don't have the timers that you see in other cities where it gives you the 20 seconds or how long you have left to cross the road. So you could be halfway across the street and the light changes before you can make it as a pedestrian. So that's part of it is infrastructure problems and sort of the history of the city as well.
I remember some years ago, there was a death of a gentleman who was trying to cross, I believe it was San Jose Boulevard, to go to Temple because it was the Sabbath and he couldn't use his car, you know, in order to be an observant Jew on the Sabbath. He was an Orthodox Jewish gentleman and he tried to cross. He hit the button to cross and he couldn't get across in 30 seconds because the light changed and he was killed. So that's just one example of how our built environment is literally set up to endanger us in this community when we go on foot. Now, you spoke with Larry Reynolds, who's part of the city's Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee. He also leads the nonprofit JTC Running. So he's advocating for walkers and bicyclists. What does he say about these numbers?
And just to clarify, his name is Larry Roberts. I had incorrectly printed that earlier this morning.
No problem.
I spent some time actually on San Jose Boulevard with Larry Roberts yesterday walking along that street because that is one of those streets that has long distances between crosswalks. We met at San Jose and University, and in either direction along San Jose Boulevard, it's almost a mile before you reach another crosswalk. So if you're a pedestrian, you either have to take the risk of jaywalking if you want to get where you're going across the street or walk a mile out of your way to the next crosswalk. So what he was saying is that one thing that he feels like we need is an inventory of all of the streets and bicycle lanes in the city. This is something that was done in 2017 when the city created a master plan for how to improve pedestrian safety. But what he's calling for with his group is an in-depth survey of all of the streets in the city and a prioritization of what needs to be repaired moving forward.
Now, the city did, as you report, increase its budget last year for adding new safe pedestrian crossings. They want to implement rectangular rapid flashing beacons, crosswalks with flashing lights outside of main intersections. Is that enough?
Maybe. So this was one of the main recommendations from the 2017 Master Plan for Pedestrian Safety. And these are crosswalks that are outside of main intersections. So they're great for places like San Jose Boulevard, where you don't have a main intersection for cars for almost a mile, but you could set up a flashing beacon crosswalk. So it has a button for pedestrians to press, the lights flash, and you could cross the street, and it warns cars that there's a pedestrian crossing. So that's something that the city has prioritized. Slightly more this year. They allocated about $250,000 to it the past few years. This year they've allocated $300,000, and the capital improvement plan moving forward allocates about $300,000 to putting in more rectangular rapid flashing beacons. But that's kind of just one part of the puzzle.
Now, of course, we're the largest city in the country by landmass, so we're not built for walking. We're not a dense environment. But that said, people still want to get out and walk, and they may choose not to because the environment just isn't set up for it. They don't want to endanger themselves. Same for bicycling, right?
It's true. And there are some other projects that are more for casual walkers that want to walk for exercise rather than trying to go places, like the Emerald Cove Trail and expanding the Riverwalk paths. Those are some projects that the city has invested in. But for people that need to walk, that don't have a car, take the bus, or need to walk to work, there's definite dangers on our main streets.
As we look at the new data showing Jacksonville has reached a new deadly record in the number of pedestrian deaths, give us a call. 549-2937, Rusty on the west side. Hi, Rusty.
Hi, good morning, you all.
Good morning.
Our town has been compared to Los Angeles itself.
Mm-hmm.
L.A. historically is notorious for its worship of internal combustion, smog. And that's actually changed a lot out there in the last 15 years. But this is Jacksonville, or the Tri-County area. This is the home of the three-lane exit. And for Florida man and or Florida woman, no pickup or SUV is quite big enough, powerful enough, or shiny enough. And if you think that way, guess what? You are Florida man or Florida woman.
You're right, Rusty. Okay, so Claire, we can try to change the built environment, but in order to improve this situation, we need to change the culture, and that's easier said than done, as he points out.
I think that is partly true, and that's one thing that the pedestrian advocate, Larry Roberts, I spoke to yesterday was saying, was that he finds that a lot of these streets, people are speeding on them, except for at rush hour, when there's not a lot of traffic on them, there ends up being a lot of cars speeding and making it unsafe for pedestrians. So it could be a driver behavior issue in part. But one thing we also saw was that pedestrians did drop in 2018. So we saw sort of a sharp drop in 2018, and that was shortly after Jacksonville created this master plan for pedestrian safety in 2017, and in the 2018 budget, they allocated about $1 million towards pedestrian safety projects. Mm-hmm. So we have seen some effectiveness of investment into infrastructure when it comes to deaths.
Catherine in Riverside. Hey, Catherine. Good morning.
Good morning. I recently moved from Mandarin to the Rail Yard District, and a big deciding factor in that was to be able to ride my bike everywhere I wanted to go, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to New York over the summer, and I hadn't been home, New York City, mm-hmm. in the past 5 years or so, and they have done so much to that city to make it much more bikeable. They actually put their bike lanes in between the sidewalk and the parked cars to give a buffer between traffic and the bicycle riders. And that's a very simple thing to do.
Yeah. Little changes like that, Catherine, thank you for pointing that out. Little changes, little tweaks can make a difference, Claire. So is the committee, this advisory committee, lobbying the city on some of these ideas?
They definitely are. And one thing that they've done independently as a committee is to go out into neighborhoods and do an informal survey. So they talk to residents and look at streets to try to figure out where things need to be done. And so some streets in our city don't even have sidewalks. There's places where a pedestrian would have to walk along the road. And San Jose Boulevard, for example, where I spent some time yesterday, the bike lane, there is a new bike lane, but it's quite small and it is right next to the turning lane. And so it doesn't have that buffer like you see in some other cities.
549-2937, lots of calls. Kat in Mandarin. Hi, Kat.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I live off Sunbeam Road, and they recently they made a school bigger, and they have one of those flickering, stop signs. But I almost feel like people will slow down for the school part, and then as soon as the school section ends, they'll just take off. So I feel like maybe there's some education needed as well. The signs I've seen out there that say that are targeted to pedestrians to tell them to look out, I feel like there needs to be something for drivers as well. Really cool I saw in Springfield, they painted crossways, and that might really be helpful for the students who are walking home from school, because Sunbeam is connected to San Jose. There's a lot of pedestrians, and even a smaller street like Sunbeam is having a lot of issues with pedestrians.
Kat, thank you so much for that report from your neck of the woods. She's right, Claire Heddles. Springfield recently painted some new crosswalks. Springfield, San Marco, Riverside, Avondale, those are really the only walkable neighborhoods in Jacksonville. And they have done those kinds of things to make them more pedestrian and bicycle friendly. But if you're not living in one of the urban core neighborhoods, you're probably out of luck. And as she also points out, pedestrians under the law have the right of way, but people don't follow that when they're in their cars.
Yeah, I think she made a great point about driver education. It is true that I think most people, when they see signs for schools, follow them and think, oh, I need to slow down. There's a school bus, there's students. But you don't necessarily have that same thought if you see one of those yield for pedestrian signs. You might look quickly and see if there's a pedestrian, but it doesn't necessarily have the same response as a school crosswalk does. And even the rectangular flashing beacons that are the newer projects that the city is kind of focusing on moving forward, the lights are fairly small. When I was there yesterday, it was really bright out. It was early in the morning, and it's pretty hard to see the flashing yellow lights. They weren't the size of a full traffic light. They're smaller flashing lights, so it would be possible for a driver to miss those.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with WJCT reporter Claire Heddles. Her new report looks at statistics showing Jacksonville has had the deadliest year ever so far in pedestrian deaths, and the year isn't even over yet. Lots of emails, tweets, and calls. Jenny emails the show, "I work downtown and cross the intersection at Main and Bay Streets every day to get between my office building and my garage. We always have a tough time crossing this intersection, even with the crosswalk lights. Drivers are constantly ignoring their red right turn lights and speeding through. I even see police cars doing this often." Here's another email. "Jacksonville drivers can be openly hostile to bikers and walkers. Other cities, particularly in the Northwest, actively accommodate bicyclists and pedestrians. We need to do better." Amy tweets the show, "Pedestrian and bicycle safety go right along with parks and recreation access that help to make the city a desirable place to live and work. We need this for a robust downtown." And on Facebook, here is Jennifer. "I live three blocks from a lovely park where my middle school age kids like to play, but I can't let them walk there as they have to cross a busy street. The speed limit is 35 miles an hour and there are crosswalks, but having walked it myself, it is still incredibly dangerous. Drivers don't pay attention. People often take right turns and don't yield to pedestrians. There is a driver culture in this city that puts drivers above all else, and that mentality is going to restrict us from moving forward on pedestrian and bicycle safety." All right, Matt in Jacksonville. Matt. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hey, yeah. I've been a cyclist for a number of years, and what I've noticed in Jacksonville is a huge number of people on bicycles going the wrong way into traffic. And my conversation. So I'm just wondering how the statistics show, you know, as far as accidents and fatalities for people that are following the rules, as opposed to as a cyclist and a driver. When I see somebody coming out at an angle, I don't know where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like there should be some responsibility on both sides.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, I mean, people might be doing that because they think it's safer, but you're supposed to go with the traffic, right, Claire?
That's true. And I think when there aren't clear bike lanes, bikers do end up doing what seems the safest in their mind in that moment at different intersections. And so that's part of what makes bike lanes so important for this city.
549-2937, Bob in Arlington. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Hi, I think there's a huge education problem amongst drivers as well as cyclists. I totally agree that cyclists need to take responsibility, and people not knowing the rules of the road going the wrong direction is a big problem. But I think drivers in Florida either don't know or don't obey the rules of the road in relation to bikes. Bikes or vehicles have the same right to the road. By Florida law, you can only pass if you can give the bike 3 feet. If it's not safe to give that 3 feet, you need to wait until it is safe to pass. And there's so many drivers in Jacksonville that will just buzz right by you an inch off your handlebars, thinking they have a God-given right to pass you anywhere. So I think we need to educate cyclists and drivers better.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, I'm getting inundated with emails, Claire, saying I feel like I take my life into my hands when I go out to walk my dog or go out for a bike ride. We've done this segment many times over the years. This new data just confirms what we've known for a long time. It's dangerous. I remember former city councilman Don Redman. He was an avid cyclist. He got knocked off his bike and almost was seriously injured some years ago. Could have died. You know, it's so unfortunate because walking and bike riding are one of the easiest ways you can go out and get some exercise without having to join a gym, but people are afraid to do it.
And I think a lot of these emailers mentioned this driver culture. Jacksonville has a driver culture. And one of the things that the pedestrian advocates that I spoke to said is that they feel like the council members do care when they bring up the issues, that there is open dialogue, but that they don't care to the point of it being personal because most of the people that have political power in this city are drivers. And so they don't have the personal knowledge every single day of having to walk and seeing the problems. And so there's definitely a gap between the driver culture, as people are talking about, and the political will, if the people making decisions are drivers.
549-2937. Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Yeah, I've been waiting. I've been listening to you for a couple of weeks now, trying to steer this conversation into the Downtown Skyway Express, which is supposed to solve all our problems. You know, we voted for this last year, and I haven't seen the first little bit of construction going on down there. Do you know anything about that or where it's going?
We will continue to follow that. No construction on that yet, Mark. And that is, you know, a way of helping people get to final destinations like the stadium and by using these autonomous vehicles. They don't necessarily encourage pedestrians, Claire. It's going to be theoretically added to our built environment at some point.
That's true. There might be another mode of transportation, but not necessarily pedestrian friendly. I know our other reporter, Ray Trinosco, has done some reporting on that. That you could find that on wjct.org. He's done some reporting about the future of the Skyway project.
Here's a tweet from Kevin. If you push the button at intersections, it does give you a little more time to cross, but that doesn't help when the buttons don't exist. Also, too many bikers will ignore traffic lights, he says. Don in Jacksonville. Don Juan, is that your name? Go ahead, Don.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I used to live in Asia for about 8 years, and I just moved back recently with my wife. And in Asia, there's a system for bikers and pedestrians that is in good place. And when we were first arrived in Jacksonville, she and I used to walk everywhere near our neighborhood to go shopping, to go to the supermarket, to go anywhere within a mile. But eventually we changed to what the culture seems to be here, which is you have to drive everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Even the school, going to the school to pick up our daughter, which is about a half a mile from, we used to walk all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems ingrained in the culture, and I guess the American culture, where you have to walk. It's sort of even, maybe even frowned upon if you're walking around everywhere. And I used to live in Texas as well. It's the same over there. And it's kind of like when you walk around, it's like, is his car break down? He probably doesn't have a car, and it's
people think you can. Yeah, people can't imagine you might be choosing to walk. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. People might think that your car broke down or you don't have a car at all. And eventually, my wife, who is Asian, we succumbed to what is the way here. Now we drive everywhere. Now we go pick up our daughter, which is about half a mile.
Yep, we lost you.
Kind of like,
yeah. Yeah, Donna, thank you for the call. And, you know, I hear that a lot when people move from somewhere where the culture is different and they're upset to see this. Thank you for that. Lots more tweets. Here's one from Jen. I live off Scott Mill Road. I constantly see drivers almost hitting cyclists along with excessive speed through residential streets. Kat tweets the show. I posted on Nextdoor to ask for tips on how to cycle San Jose, and people said it's not safe. George on the north side. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Yes. I've been a school bus driver for 19 years, and I drive all through Jacksonville. 80% of the people just hit the button and start walking. They never pay attention to the light when it's okay to go. I think that's one of our major problems.
Thank you, George. Okay. Yeah, so with all of this said, Claire Heddles, here's a bit of good news for people that want to walk and bike. The Emerald Trail is underway. That is a green beltway that Groundwork Jacksonville is working to construct all around the city. It will be a beautiful bike and pedestrian path that will go through all of the neighborhoods. It will have plants and flowers, and it will be a beautiful place to walk or cycle, and it will be safe. We can look forward to that at least once that's constructed, because those kinds of green belts have been successful in other cities that are car dependent, like, say, Atlanta.
That's so true. And I think your caller a minute ago made a great point that the built environment does drive activity. He wanted to walk, he and his wife wanted to walk, but the built environment drove him to driving. And so the Emerald Trail is a possibility to drive people more towards walking, though. That more so, I think, is for recreational walkers and cyclists, and it won't necessarily help some of the problems for people that are walking to work, walking to bus stops,
yeah,
and want to walk their kids to school, sort of those smaller pedestrian trips.
You can read more about this at WJCT.org. Claire Heddles, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Melissa.
Speaking of WJCT News, we are very excited to announce here at WJCT Public Media that the Arthur Vining Davis Foundation has awarded a grant of $500,000 to our local journalism initiative. This initiative is aimed at strengthening local news reporting in Northeast Florida. The Florida Blue Foundation, Vistar Credit Union, and the Community Foundation of Northeast Florida have also made commitments of support along with individual donors. To date, we've raised more than $1 million in grants. What we're doing is expanding local reporting capabilities in our online digital news. We're kicking it off with a new newsletter, Jacksonville Today. It has launched this week, and we urge you to subscribe to it. Now, Jacksonville Today will also eventually be a digital daily newspaper for this city. And it adds to the content that we are creating here at WJCT News. We've also hired Randy Roguski as senior news editor. He was previously the metro editor at the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and he led investigative coverage that won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. And so as we beef up our coverage of this community, we want you to be part of it. We want you to subscribe to our newsletter, Jacksonville Today. Just go to the website, jackstoday.org, and sign up for your local weekday newsletter for news and ways to get involved in Northeast Florida. And there's more to come in this space. But again, sign up for our new newsletter. Go to jackstoday.org. Just enter your email and subscribe. It's free. Thanks so much. And much more still ahead. Later, jury selection is underway in Georgia in the murder trial of the men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery. But up next.
What that does is it trains the immune system to fight, you know, specific proteins that are on viruses, for example, or cancers.
With all the talk about vaccines for COVID, what's gotten lost is research for a vaccine that will fight cancer. We'll get an update from Mayo Clinic after this. Well, with all of the vaccination discussion going on right now, we thought it was timely to talk about vaccines in cancer research, including breast cancer. Vaccines to both prevent and treat breast cancer are in development now. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and for more, we spoke with Dr. Keith Knudsen at Jacksonville's Mayo Clinic.
Dr. Knudsen, good to talk to you, and thanks for joining us. So tell us, what is a vaccine for cancer? Is that the same as other types of vaccines?
It is, actually. It's very, very similar. The principles are all the same. With an infectious disease vaccine, and I think, you know, the COVID vaccine is mainly on people's minds right now, what that does is it trains the immune system to fight, you know, specific proteins that are on viruses, for example, or cancers. And the goal of the vaccine is to stimulate both what we call T-cell and B-cell immunity. So T-cells are fighter cells that circulate through the blood and try to find either the viral infection or the bacterial infection or the cancer, whereas B-cells are a type of cell that secrete antibodies. And these antibodies can circulate throughout the blood and they can activate the immune response to whatever they're targeting as well. Very similar.
This is such exciting news. What's available in the way of this kind of shot right now, or is it still being studied?
Well, for the most part, they're still being studied. There is a lot of hope that we can develop vaccines for cancers. There are actually cancer vaccines that are available. Two of the vaccines target cancers that are related to viruses. So, for example, hepatitis viruses can cause cancer. It's a long process. So you have infection and then you have inflammation in the liver and that ultimately leads to the development of a cancer. Same with human papillomavirus and cervical cancer. So we have vaccines that target those viruses and can actually prevent those cancers from developing. There's also another therapeutic vaccine for prostate cancer that is available in the clinic for treatment of patients with advanced prostate cancer. Those are the only three that are available that, you know, have some impact on cancers. In the scientific arena, in the investigational arena, there are lots of different types of cancer vaccines that are being developed. And these are typically specific for certain kinds of cancers. So if you have breast cancer, for example, there's a number of, including our group, a number of groups that are developing vaccines that can either be used to treat breast cancer, prevent it from coming back, or to prevent it from coming, on in the first place, primary prevention vaccine.
Yeah, that begs my next question. Would a breast cancer vaccine be most efficacious, most popular as a preventative, or for someone who is already positive for the disease or who has already had it?
Yeah, so we think about three different strategies that we use vaccines for in breast cancer. So we can give a vaccine to an individual that has cancer in their body. And typically that's not the optimal approach because cancers that form in an individual's body suppress the immune response. And so even though you can generate these T cells and B cells for that cancer, it's very difficult for them to get in and have activity against the cancer just because the tumors figure out ways to suppress that immune response. Now, we are developing strategies where we can block that local immune suppression in the tumor. And so there may be opportunities in the future to give vaccines to individuals that have cancer in their body. Mm. The alternative approaches that we think about in our group are as a means of prevention. There's two forms available. There is a form in which we give vaccines after an individual has been treated for cancer, but they no longer have evidence of any disease in their body. And so we can immunize them to prevent that cancer from coming back. And then lastly, as I had already alluded to, there are vaccines that are being developed for primary prevention. So think about it in the context of, you know, familial breast cancer where, you know, individuals have a high risk of developing breast cancer for whatever reason, some genetic mutation. We could develop vaccines, and we're currently developing those, that can be given to those individuals that are considered at high risk, but before they get cancer, in order to stop that cancer from growing.
It sounds amazing, but it's a ways off, isn't it?
It is a ways off. There are a number of new different strategies that are becoming available. And in the modern times in science, we have now the capability of assessing an individual's genetic information. And so we're looking at better approaches at, you know, trying to determine what the vaccine should be made of so that they can be applied at the personal level to an individual. And so those vaccines are actually probably going to be approved within the next 5 or 10 years. When you think about something for primary prevention where you have to take it through clinical trials and you have to watch patients over many, many years, you know, that can take a couple of decades. What we need to do is we need to, you know, keep abreast of the science behind vaccines and what it's going to take to get those into ultimately publicly use. And we need to be vigilant in our approach to, you know, continue to investigate them and design clinical trials that will help us understand their, you know, potential usefulness. Because I think, you know, in terms of primary prevention, that's probably going to be the only way that we're really going to solve the major problem of breast cancer, for example, which, you know, attacks 400,000 women every year in the U.S. And you know, kills another 40 to 50,000 women. Primary prevention is probably going to be the most effective way to reduce the incidence death rate for breast cancer in the U.S. and even worldwide.
Thanks for these insights as we mark Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Dr. Keith Knudsen, Mayo Clinic, with the Mayo Clinic Ovarian Cancer Immunotherapy Program, among other roles there. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, jury selection continues today in Brunswick, Georgia, in the murder trial for the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. Three white men are accused of chasing down and killing Arbery, a 25-year-old black man who was out for a jog. Gregory McMichael, his son Travis, and their neighbor William Roddy Bryan Jr. are charged with malice and felony murder. They have all pleaded not guilty. The men also face charges of aggravated assault, false imprisonment, and criminal attempt to commit it. Now, Arbery was shot in February of last year while he was out jogging in Brunswick. The incident was partially captured on video. The McMichaels claimed they were conducting a citizen's arrest on Arbery, who they suspected of burglary, and that they shot the man in self-defense. After the shooting, the three men were allowed to leave the scene and weren't arrested until after video of the incident went viral. Ann Schindler of First Coast News is in Brunswick covering the trial, and she's on the line. Hi, Ann.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning.
Good morning. So this trial being watched across the country, even the world, how is jury selection proceeding?
Slowly.
Yeah.
They took 20 out of a potential pool of 1,000 yesterday. They got through 12. They dismissed all 12. So, it's not like they're flying through and making a great deal of progress. They've got another 20 potential jurors in there today. They started this morning, and asking them the questions about whether they know any of the defendants, whether they've ever been arrested, whether they know, people in the criminal defense world, that kind of stuff. So bearing down on it, I guess, but a really long way to go. And I'll tell you, too, the number of people showing up for jury duty is a fraction of those that have been called today. They're on their second group of 20 today. But the number, the jury number, the people coming in is like in the 70s right now. So you can do the math and see that that's, maybe about 40 or 50% showing up.
Certainly with such a heavily publicized case in a small community, finding a jury will be challenging. There's been so much discussion about it. And can you tell us a little bit about what we might expect the defense to argue in this case? These men claim they were trying to make a citizen's arrest of Arbery, but of course the video seems to tell a very different story. So what possible defense might their attorney put forth in court?
Well, while this case is, obviously very, you've got to excuse them outside the courthouse, there's some birds in the background, but this is a very, well-watched case. But the fact is, at the time, there was this archaic Civil War era citizens arrest law that allowed citizens to detain someone that they thought was committing a felony. And so they're going to be arguing, this law was in place at the time. They were operating under the apprehension that Ahmaud Arbery was burglarizing the home that he was in. As you say, the surveillance video, shows that that's not the case. And of course, they didn't find anything stolen on him. But they're going to argue that they attempted to lawfully detain Ahmaud Arbery, that he, began striking Travis McMichael, the video sort of bears that portion of it out, and that he shot himself, in self-defense. So that's going to be their argument. That is going to be heavily dependent on the video, as you say, that was shot by one of the three defendants, which really does show the lead up to the pursuit, of Ahmaud Arbery through this Satilla Shores neighborhood and then the confrontation.
After the video went viral, there was fallout in the local prosecutor's office, wasn't there? Because they allowed the men to leave the scene and they were at large. They were never even arrested until the video placed pressure on local law enforcement. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that's the thing that for so many people really strikes a chord is that, you have a body in the street and, a gentleman who's literally got blood on his hands, who isn't, detained, who isn't arrested. And I think that there's sort of a world view that if the roles had been flipped, in terms of race, that it would have been a very different situation in terms of how law enforcement regarded somebody who had shot somebody dead in the street. But there was a lot of fallout because they weren't arrested until the video became public and brought a lot of pressure to bear on prosecutors and law enforcement. But the original district attorney is now under indictment for the way that she handled the case and for showing, I think they said, affection and favor to one of the now defendants, Gregory McMichael, the father of the shooter who worked for her, who worked for Jackie Johnson, the former district attorney, as an investigator and had a history of law enforcement. And when you watch the body cam video, you can see this this relationship that he had with law enforcement. One of the officers is even asking another officer, don't you recognize him? That's, Greg McMichael, So even an understanding of the officers that were just responding to this scene, that this was somebody that was kind of in law enforcement, clearly recognized it, whether they were mm-hmm. extra deferential or not.
The killing of Ahmaud is just one of so many incidents involving black men in this country being shot, often by police, but sometimes by civilians. There is certainly fear, I would say, among many trial watchers that these men might not be convicted in the crime. At the same time, Anne, there's a flap in Jacksonville, a committee in Jacksonville called Safer Together, which issued a report about mistrust between law enforcement and African Americans here, and looked at whether we need a civilian review board in Jacksonville to look at police shootings of civilians. City Councilman Michael Boylan has resigned from this committee, leaving only Councilmember Joyce Morgan to head it up. We'll be covering that in more detail this week. But, you know, this is a problem that is affecting communities across the country. And this case in Brunswick was really a flashpoint in the push for racial justice and criminal justice reform. What are people in the town saying about that as the jury selection goes on?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Benjamin Crump, who's an attorney that's been, you know, helping the family kind of from the beginning of this case, was here yesterday with Ahmaud Arbery's father, Marcus Arbery Sr. And he said, you know, he sees similarities between this case and the killing of Trayvon Martin in Orlando several years ago. And he said, you know, this is another case where a young black man was shot and killed by a citizen in a neighborhood. But the difference is that in this case, there's video. And he said that because of that video, his expectation is that the outcome will be different. So this video, interestingly, you know, was released by one of the defendants in the expectation / hope that it was going to kind of clear their reputation, clear their name, you know, provide clarity that this was, in fact, a legitimate shooting. And, of course, it had, you know, pretty much the opposite effect from what they anticipated. But it is going to be central to this case. And, you know, I think that because there is that video, there is a sense that there might be a different outcome.
Yeah, I mean, the killing of Jordan Davis in Jacksonville, a teen who was killed on Black Friday some years ago because he and his friends were playing loud music at a gas station. The white man who killed him, he wasn't initially convicted right away. That took two trials to convict him in that murder. If video had existed of that incident, it might have been different. So always so great to get your insights. Ann Schindler of First Coast News, she is in Brunswick, Georgia this week, covering the trial of the men accused of killing 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery. Anne, thank you so much for taking some time with us, and we'll check in with you soon.
You bet. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. And in a moment, how you can take this month's Go Green Challenge in the city. We'll tell you about that and some other green news and notes from around the Sunshine State. That's coming up in a few moments. Keep listening. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
The Jacksonville Symphony's spectacular fall season continues with performances of Bach's lively Brandenburg Concerto No. 1, performed for you in Jacoby Symphony Hall, October 22nd and 23rd. Treat yourself to a sensational evening of live classical music, a night out to be shared with family and friends. Tickets and information at jacksymphony.org.
Hi, Hi, I'm Brendan Rivers, lead reporter for ADAPT, WJCT's website and newsletter on climate change. This year's State of the River report says we should be worried about the health of the St. Johns, hear local officials react to this year's findings, and talk about what they think should be done to protect the St. Johns River. Join us for a virtual panel discussion on Wednesday, October 20th. Register now at wjct.org/events.
Hello, it's Michelle Martin. 50 years ago, NPR's first broadcast captured different perspectives at a march against the Vietnam War. They brought you the voices of the marchers, the counter-demonstrators, and the local police. NPR is still bringing you voices from down the street and around the world. Celebrate NPR 50, then, now, and next.
America is home to hundreds of thousands of dying oil and gas wells, and because they leak, they're a liability. But there's money to be made from these toxic, rusty relics. We'll hear more about a new investigation on the dangers they pose and the profits being made to plug the many gaps. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Today's segment of Going Green is sponsored in part by North Florida Land Trust.
Welcome back. Well, you can take the Go Green Challenge this month. For more, I spoke with Josh Rosenberg of Native Jack's Permaculture.
Thanks for having me, Melissa. Yeah, we're doing the Go Green Challenge, and our goal is to challenge 1,000 people to make one small change from now until the end of the year that helps improve the environment. And we are going to interview 6 local leaders from October 25th to the 31st every day from 5 to 6, and to help inspire people on the changes that they can make at their home and their business and their day-to-day lives. You just want to help people, you know, think about the environment and be a little bit more eco-conscious.
By reducing the waste we create, kind of hard with no recycling in the city, but we can still do it, composting, becoming more aware of our daily choices, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We're going to be interviewing people in the government like Ashante Green and Chris Kelkors of the Northeast Florida Green Business Chamber, Shop Joyful with reducing waste and no packaging. We're going to talk about fertilizer alternatives, nonprofit with Groundworks Jacks and Chanel Bryant, composting for sure, and then we're going to talk about all of that and how we can make implementation to just have a better system that we're living in.
Check it out, everybody, at gogreen.nativejacks.com. And thank you, Josh. Joshua Rosenberg, founder at Native Jacks Permaculture Design and Real Estate.
More green news. Florida's Volo Foundation is seeking talented graduate students to drive climate solutions in Florida. For more on their VISTA award, I checked in with Volo's Nicole Salzberg.
Nicole Salzberg, good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
So tell us about this opportunity from the Volo Foundation, the VISTA Award. This is a really interesting opportunity for students. What all is involved?
Sure. So the Volo VISTA Award is something that we give away. It's a $10,000 grant that is paid to the student's university, and it's for graduate students who are working on climate solutions. Specifically climate solutions that can be applied to the state of Florida. So right now, you know, the application is open through November 30th. We're inviting all graduate students working on those solutions for Florida to apply. And it's a great, you know, it's a great award. We've given it out 3 times to, you know, all different types of projects that can fall under that sort of climate solution umbrella. But yeah, I mean, it's a great project that we are really, you know, we hold really close to us. It's always wonderful to see these students who are so brilliant and so committed to moving the needle on climate. So the application's open. Once it closes, our finalists will be invited to present their projects at the Climate Correction Conference in March.
So what are examples of the kinds of projects that have won in the past?
Sure. So in 2019, we actually gave it out to 2 different projects, the first one being a resiliency project with mangrove infrastructure, and that was a student from FIU. And then the other one was a food waste recovery system And it was sort of a framework for establishing the system in Central Florida, and that was for a student from UCF. Most recently, this past April at our Climate Correction Conference, we awarded to another FIU student who was working on a climate mobility framework for equitable sea level rise adaptation. So, yeah, I mean, you know, these students are so brilliant, and we purposely left the VISTA sort of open because when you talk about climate solutions, it can involve so many different disciplines. It, you know, there's no one-fix-all solution. So we invite all students from all different disciplines. If they're working in this space, we want to hear from them.
We should make a plug for our contribution to this effort here at WJCT Public Media. We cover climate adaptation and mitigation solutions and challenges at our digital magazine, adaptflorida.org. And so that is going to be the way it goes in Florida, isn't it, Nicole? Figuring out how to adapt, how to mitigate, how to innovate. Also, of course, the big imperative is to draw down carbon emissions, but at the same time, we're going to have to get creative about these kinds of solutions. So tapping the brilliance of students seems like a smart way to go.
Yeah, I mean, and this generation is different, and they're on board, and they're aggressively working towards these solutions as well. It's really inspiring to see, and makes us feel a little bit better about the fact that, you know, this climate crisis that this next generation has inherited from us, they're taking very seriously, and they're working towards changing that. So it is, and it's going to take all hands on deck. All different disciplines have a role to play. So we just love seeing what comes in and the creativity and the innovation from these students. It's really inspiring.
And this VISTA Award stands for Vision, Innovation, Sustainability, Technology, and Action in Climate Solutions. So just to make sure everyone understands, if you're a student at the graduate level, enrolled full-time in any U.S.-based university or college, you can apply to receive the $10,000 VISTA Award. People need to go to your website, volofoundation.org, to apply, correct?
Absolutely. volofoundation.org/VISTA. It's the link to the application is there. It's pretty simple. And I just want to note that it doesn't have to be an individual. We've also had teams apply for this project. So it's, you know, for the specific project that we're funding. So if it's a team, we welcome them to apply as well.
Check it out, everyone. It's the VISTA Award, as the Volo Foundation will determine the project that best drives positive change in Florida climate solutions. VoloFoundation.org/VISTA. Nicole Salzberg, Events and Development Coordinator with the Volo Foundation. Thanks for joining us. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.